We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Heyo, and here we go. This is a We Talk Comics interview special. Returning with us is our most popular guest of 2015. So before we introduce him, I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Keith. I'm the co-host of the show, joined by Chris.
I'm excited for this one.
And our guest again, last time we talked to him, he was launching some books. He's back to launch some more books. Dan Juergens.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure. Always good to be here.
And now we're having you back because since the last time we talked, you have written what is arguably the most important comic of the past 5 years of DC. And I might go a step further and say the culmination of your comics work for more than two decades.
Now, isn't that overstating Batmite a little bit?
No, not at all. I mean, it's quite apropos to Batmite.
Batmite number four was where I was going with that. Thanks for stepping on my punchline, Chris. Batmite and Booster Gold happened last time we talked about. And there's another little book you got happening too.
Yeah.
Not to be outdone by Batmite meets Booster Gold.
Right, exactly. Obviously, you're referring to Batmite number five and the inferior five.
I read that one over lunch too. We're almost to the end of Batmite. I'm going to miss the little guy.
I am too. You know, and I know we want to get on to other things, but Batmite really has been an awful lot of fun to work on. And Corinne Howell has done really great work on it. She draws such an expressive Batmite. And, you know, in a world of comics where you go in the store every week and you just see so much sameness on the racks and the shelves, and just to see something that I think is lighthearted and fun, I certainly had a lot of fun doing it. And I hope people enjoyed reading it. Just if for no other reason than if you go home with that stack of comics, I think something should have a little bit of a different feel to it.
You know, it actually would be a perfect fit for the digital line where they're going for something a little bit different on every one of their titles.
Right.
And, I mean, you had said, we talked to you when you were starting Batmite, and you hinted that there were certainly, you know, there's fun, there's humor to the book, but you had a couple more things to say that you wanted to make statements about. And I think we've seen that come out. And I've enjoyed the little, like, the nudges toward constant change in comics and the nudges toward keep everything frozen in
right.
comics.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to be, you know, honest here, one of the things is that, in a way, what we were trying to do was, I always use Pee Wee Herman and Pee Wee's Playhouse a little bit as an example, with the idea that if you watch that show, it kind of functioned on two levels. One is kids just thought it was zany fun. You know, mom and dad could sit there and say, I can't believe they just said that. And they did a very good job of kind of walking this great tightrope between entertainment for kids and entertainment for adults. And we tried to do that in Batmite a little bit. We touched on a couple of social commentary type things just a bit, like, you know, referencing Generation Selfie and stuff like that. But at the same time, we just tried to have some good old fashioned fun with the character and the guest star. So, you know, we, like I say, it was different to work on, and it was always very refreshing for me to work on.
And I couldn't stop laughing when I got to Black Gold. That was whenever anyone complains about a current version of their favorite character, I always say that, you know, there was about 5 years where Booster Gold was Iron Man and was missing an arm. So,
oh my God. Yeah. And, you know, I'd go into the office and I would just say, what the hell are you guys doing? Why don't you like me anymore? Some trying to kill me off here.
Extreme Justice was the bomb. Come on.
That was it was a 90s take. A lot of people are down on the 90s, but I mean, I think it was kind of about about 3 years of the 90s was really that kind of era. Kind of like when the market started to fall, and everyone.
Oh, you can mark the point in the 90s when Ninjak came out at Valiant. That was the line right there. Purple ninjas.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is true. There are certain. You're right. People love to bash the 90s a little bit. I look back on it and I say, I think there was a tremendous amount of fun there. There was a tremendous amount of excitement that was happening at that time. But yes, like anything else, there were more than a fair share of sins. And if you want to point to Booster Gold as an example, you know, no one can deny it. It's there. So anyway, we're kind of getting off topic here.
I'm not terrible. If we're going to talk about Booster Gold, really, we can keep going.
30th anniversary coming up.
Oh, that's true. You have to wait till 75 years for the fancy hardcover retrospective collection, right?
Well, apparently so. I mean, my God.
At least since last we talked, we've got Volume 1 issues coming out digitally now. Yeah. So it's available to read, which I'm excited about.
It is. Well, and you know what's weird? I have to say that I went on and I actually downloaded it myself, if for no other reason than it kind of serves as a testament to this idea that when we first did the book, really the concept of even collected editions of any kind was something you couldn't even wrap your head around. I mean, that was not at all the common currency of comics. It was like it came out in June and it was gone in July, and if you wanted it, the only way to get it was in back issues. So it's, you know, on the one hand, just getting to the point where you have collected editions is something that when I was doing that book, you really couldn't fathom. But you sure as hell couldn't fathom anything like an iPad and the idea that you would get comics that way and be able to read them. And so for that reason alone, I just had to do it.
And it is strange for me to read, particularly Superman, but now Booster, I haven't looked at the issues. I've bought all the issues that are up digitally so far, but I haven't read them yet. But having read those Supermans over and over from the Burn era and into the Triangle era, looking at them in digital, now that they've bleached the background so that those pages are against pure white instead of against newsprint, right. It's such a different look to the books than the memory of them.
It is, but I, you know, to a certain extent, I think that's true of any format we reread these stories in. Because I know for me, I've always thought, and this is sometimes I feel this way, sometimes I don't kind of thing, but in a way, if we look back on our comic reading experiences, one of the big aspects of it was always the ads that were contained therein. You know, it's like, you don't only remember the issue and the story and who wrote it and who drew it and why it affected you somehow. If you was something you read when you were 10 years old, you remember what the ad was on the back cover. Mm-hmm. Or you remember a house ad that was in the middle of the book where you just said, oh my God, I can't wait until that issue of Batman comes out. And that's something that's lost when we get it in a collected edition as well. So you're right. It's the color is different. The experience is different. The loss of tangibility is a part of it as well. So there are a lot of things that go into it.
I had that experience just recently. We were talking about movies, and I mentioned Megaforce, which is an early 80s action movie that came out about the same time as Buckaroo Banzai.
Right.
And I said, I don't remember the movie, but I clearly remember that they bought back covers on Marvel for a whole summer. And I remember the poster being up when I went to see Return of the Jedi at the drive-in. That's all I remember. But I remember clearly the back cover of the comics for several months.
Right.
Was this movie. And I picked up all of the print issues of Armageddon 2001 a few months back. Probably my favorite crossover event of the 90s. And part of it was that I've now given up that they're ever going to make a collected edition of this thing.
Probably. Although you never know.
I've requested a few times. But the other is, I had a lot of memory of rereading those books over and over. And now I'm looking at with them with the different house ads, because they ran over a summer, so they changed out every couple of books. And what was going on in the other books at the time, because you get those, whatever crossover is happening in Superman at the time. Yeah, it brings back more than the story memory, for sure.
Right, and I think, you know, the reality of house ads that you might have seen for Superman books, and I think this has been mentioned elsewhere, but one thing that Mike Carlin was always good about was preparing his own house ads for our books, because we weren't always given those ads. And what had often happened is that all of a sudden you had a different book running late. And I'll just pick out a name here, although this wasn't actually one of the books, I don't think. But let's say Green Lantern was running late that month, and no one had time to pull together a letters column. All of a sudden, Mike would show up with a house ad for, here's our Hellblazer issue of Superman, and plug it in, and all of a sudden we were set to go. So, you know, that's one reason you saw those, because Mike Carlin was very, very good about preparing stuff that could be used, even though it wasn't supposed to be a house ad, and we were there to claim the space.
I saw someone tweet out that it was a house ad for Superman Dead Again was the storyline, and it had the triangle not the issue numbers it was going to be in, but the triangle numbers, so like 1994 and 48 through 1995 2.
Sure.
I still miss those. I still say
that the triangle numbers were one of the greatest things we ever came up with. And I'm quite sure that was Mike. And the fact is, now I will, you know, sit down with a stack of comics, and this is true of both Marvel and DC, and you start to pick them up, and it's you know, it's a storyline that is going across titles and everything else, and I just look at it and say, I don't know where the hell to start. Much less, you know, I don't want to read chapter 3 and find out later was, you know, I was supposed to read it first and then come back and all this other stuff. And I have a complete failure to understand why other people don't latch on to the system, because it works great.
Well, I think part of the problem may be that nobody really knows anymore in a crossover what comes first.
That's true.
I did look at Millennium recently. And I mean, that was one of the ones that I liked. It was, as far as the way it was structured, story-wise, that's a different discussion. But I mean, 8 weeks, one issue a week of the event itself, and everything branded as week one, week two. Yep. Very clean.
Yeah. Once upon a time, the industry used to care about casual readers. Now it doesn't give a shit. Seriously. And it's really sad to see that when we would have been going and dealing with those crossovers, from a publishing perspective, we felt, you know, certainly that it was important to build it in such a way that people knew where to go and kind of what order it should be read in and how the whole thing really should work. And a lot of that was because we were aware that there were casual readers out there, that we weren't necessarily building a product with the idea that that reader was going to be walking into a comic shop every single week, that he might have been buying them in a drugstore or a candy store or something like that, or a 7-Eleven, and that, you know, he might get there every couple of weeks instead. And, you know, we made efforts to make our material clear and understandable, And I think that is one of the things that, as an industry, we have really fallen apart on.
Yeah, I think not only in the structure of what's in the issue, but also that idea that that research is a component of reading. So I've heard that argument of, well, you can just look it up on Wikipedia. I'm like, well, if I wanted to read the story on Wikipedia, I would just read it there. It's a lot cheaper. That's right. Not the experience I want, though.
Yeah. And it's really true. And I think part of it, the flip side of the argument is that as soon as you try and get too, shall I say, detailed, too clear, or too upfront about explaining things, that then is when the reviewers really start to crucify you, and it turns into something that starts to feel like it is intended for perhaps a less sophisticated or younger reader, when it isn't. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to play fair, again, with what I will call the more casual reader.
Now, how do you balance? I mean, because I know the counter argument is that's then clunky when it's collected. Because, I mean, you do see that if you read 80s stuff, particularly Jim Shooter era Marvel, when he required there be a page of catch-up in every issue. And now
that... Oh, clunky, man, you love doing this rant, man. but telling your stories of Johnny Storm recapping everything that just happened in the last issue all by himself because he's the only one in the scene.
I love that one. two characters trapped alone in space, and then they have to tell each other what has happened just to the two of them. It's the last issue. But I mean, how do you balance? I mean, the book is still primarily the weekly floppy edition, but long term is going to likely be read by more people in a pile. I don't like, where is the balance of those two things for you, Dan?
It's always a bit of a trick. And one of the things I have certainly done on Batman Beyond, for example, is with the awareness of what that audience is and everything, we have kind of pulled back from resupplying that level of information on an every issue basis for that exact reason. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that when we got done with Future's End, we had a few characters that survived into the Batman Beyond world, and we have stayed away from them. And one of the reasons is because in order to launch a new series and to play fair with new readers, we would have had to have spent time explaining who everybody else was and how they got there. So as an effort to sort of streamline the storytelling approach, we made the decision to just focus on Tim Drake and Batman and let it go at that, and to really function at that level. To build a bit of a segue into Lois and Clark here, the first issue of that opens up with a flashback. And we're going to do that for the first several issues because we want to supply that level of back information as to who these characters are, why they do what they do, and where they are in the world. The difference is it's going to work because it hasn't been seen elsewhere. And I think, you know, in a way, when you read something like that, it can feel like, oh, my gosh, did I miss an issue? So we are very consciously making it clear that, no, this is fresh material. It might be a flashback. You might be seeing an episode of their lives, but you're seeing something different.
Now, has there been much kickback? Terry McGinnis was loved. And I tried to explain to a friend the other day that, you know, Batman Beyond still exists, but he's not Terry McGinnis anymore. Has there been any fan reaction that you've heard?
You know, it's really weird. Certainly at first there was. And as I have done conventions over the course of the last few months since the book has been out, what I've been getting more is the reaction of, you know, I couldn't believe it when you guys changed it from Terry to Tim Drake, but I find myself liking Tim Drake. And I think that's exactly what we were hoping for. And a lot of that is because I have always said, I think Tim Drake in his own right is a really great character. And if I go back to, especially like when Chuck Dixon was writing his book, I really thought that that was a great book. And I think Tim is a very compelling character. I like the mix he is of a of an individual who is really smart and practical and level-headed without having, you know, the obsessiveness that some of the other Bat characters have had. Tim is very human, and I think that's a good thing. So I think he fits well into the series, and he also helps build a bridge to the DC present. So we kind of have DC represented both in future and present at the same time, so that when we do things like use, you know, the Batman robo suit or the green kryptonite ring like we did recently and things like that, it's a cool melding of past and the future. So I think that works well.
Well, it's an interesting balance because, I mean, it's certainly you're going to have a lot of people coming in with the knowledge of Batman Beyond. And I'm, as usual, I'm the contrary one. I never watched Batman Beyond and was very invested in Future's End. So I'm coming in from that other direction. Yeah, I think I'd be pretty lost if you had a whole bunch of Batman Beyond characters in the content and were introduced as, you know, that guy.
Sure. Well, and, you know, but that you bring up a very good point, which is I think Batman Beyond first debuted, the cartoon that is, I think was 99, might have been 2000. So all of a sudden, we're talking about a cartoon that is approximately 15 years old. And that's where we've always said, you know, there are even a lot of people out there who maybe didn't watch Batman Beyond first run. Maybe they saw it later. Maybe their older brothers had the action figures or something. I don't know. They have this awareness of who Batman Beyond is, but not necessarily that bond that others do. And that's part of playing it fair, which is to treat it like a fresh property with some new concepts behind it that can be, you know, that belongs to the readers of today.
Now let's shift over to Superman, Lois, and Clark. Last time we talked to you, at the very end of the show, you said, I'm working on a thing that I can't talk about. You're definitely going to want to have me back on the show to talk about it, though.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't remember. Yeah, I did. Yes. Okay.
So this was the secret project. How long from when the first conversation started of the married Lois and Clark have to come back? Does this go back in time?
I think the better question might be, not that I want to put words in your mouth, but I think it gets more to, this idea that concepts develop over time in general. So let's go back to the start of Convergence. And, you know, Convergence was, from a very rudimentary standpoint, was this idea of, gee, DC Comics is going to be moving offices from the East Coast to the West Coast. How are we going to make that happen? It's going to be really tough to keep all the full line of books going at the same time. So a group of people sat down one night, and we kind of put together the real skeletal idea of what became Convergence. And as part of that, you know, one night, Jeff Lemire and Brian Azzarello and I were sitting in the hotel bar after a full day of meetings and just kind of unwinding. We started talking about Lois and Clark and the idea that in the Convergence issue, they have a baby. And that's where we really built it in. We got into this idea of the two issues that were Convergence Superman that I worked on with Lee Weeks and then drew the second one myself. So that's where you start to build in this idea. And as part of that, I'd kind of say, boy, you know, it'd be fun to follow these guys sometime, you know, in terms of their story. And everything kind of went away. And one day, Dan DiDio gave me a call and he said, so this Lois and Clark thing, well, what, you want to do it? said, well, you need me to say yes. Why don't you just write my name down? But I think that's more how things happen, is that you start off with one idea and it rolls you into the next and the next and the next. And all of a sudden you have a book called Lois and Clark. And in that conversation, Dan even said, I've always wanted to do a book called Lois and Clark, so let's go ahead. And that's really where the transition came from. And the idea became really getting them onto the current DC Earth and the present DC Universe.
Now, I think it's fair to say that there's some debate about the ending of Convergence and what it means.
Right.
And I think you touch on a bit of that in Lois and Clark. Is the world that Lois and Clark came from an existing place they can return to?
At present, no.
Okay. And wow, that was much more direct than I expected, Dan.
Well, I think we've been pretty clear about that in the story itself. And it's funny that I was surprised to see doubt about it, but really the way we have always treated these characters in terms of where they are right now is Clark has lost two worlds and, you know, Krypton and now this other Earth. And I think that's very much who they are. And that's a very influential aspect as to how they live their lives. If we go back to the Convergence issue, there was a point, and this would have been Superman Convergence number 2. There was a point where Thomas Wayne, whose son Bruce had died on the Flashpoint Earth, says to Clark, whatever you do, take care of that child. You know, don't ever let anything happen to him. Do whatever is necessary to protect him. That's just one of the conversations that really becomes the core conceit of what this book is and how these characters currently live. That, you know, even though I'm not necessarily going to reference that straight up, if you kind of consider their adventure as having started in Superman Convergence number 1, for example, that governs why they're doing what they're doing, the way they're doing it, and how they're living right now.
And I was interested that you chose that flashback at the beginning to the beginnings of the New 52, that when they entered the New 52 universe, it was at that point Justice League number 1, or Justice League number 5, I guess.
Six.
That is. And I was interested in how you reflected where these characters come from, and then the different tone, but that different feel of the New 52 universe and how heroes relate to people. How humans relate to heroes and how heroes relate to them.
Sure. I think it's something that we're all aware of. And one of the reasons I did it this way is I've always felt that when the New 52 started, by jumping, you know, 5 years in, I think as readers, we felt that we were lacking in context, that all of a sudden we had a line of books and we didn't necessarily know how they all fit together. Justice League was great because, you know, we saw the first time those heroes got together in that very story. But as far as the universe goes, you know, we were really starting 5 years in. And what we missed then were sort of these building blocks as to how we got where we were. So as I started to put this book together, one of the things I said was, well, you know, especially if we're going to have 22 pages, let me build in some of the backstory. And the general thought is going to be that as you start to read subsequent issues of Lois and Clark, each one is going to have, say, a 6 or 7 page flashback story that shows you a bit of a progression as to how Clark and Lois were getting along in their lives. So really what we saw in issue 1 was, you know, something that represents their first couple of days here on this earth. In number 2, all of a sudden you're going to see John. He's just a little bit older. You'll meet the farmer whose land they're living on, things like that. And the idea is to show you those important stages and some of the important developments in their lives that bring you up to date in the present.
And, I mean, there were a few things left at the end of Convergence, a few toys to play with. We know Parallax is going to Talos. Is it pronounced Talos?
Yes.
Talos. All right. So we know Parallax is ending up there. You mentioned in Lois and Clark, Barry Allen and Supergirl. Do they have a destination, or will you be? Do you have them to play with later?
On that one, I would say stay tuned.
How much can we get out of Dan in one interview?
Yeah, exactly. Hit the line. Here's what happens in issue 9.
and you again touch on it just in a single page in Lois and Clark, but there's also the missing chapter, the battle with the Anti-Monitor that's between Convergence and this.
Right.
Is that one yours?
That is, I think that one is out there. I think that in order to properly deal with that, it gets so expansive that is something that would be very hard to fit into this particular book. I mean, to me, that is something that is its own massive story waiting to be told. And I'm not sure, you know, even how much we'd ever really want to get into that, because I don't think anyone feels like they want to really touch too much on what is a great piece of work in Crisis on Infinite Earths. So in my head, this is one of those where you just say, it's here, it's happened. Your imagination, I think, is almost more powerful sometimes than fact. And let's just leave it. What it was is this big traumatic event in the past.
Chris, you got anything you want to jump in with?
Sure. My questions aren't as intelligent as yours, so I've been quiet and just listening. I was wondering, the Lois and Clark logo, did you have anything to do with designing that? You've mentioned you love the triangle numbers. It somehow seems reminiscent of those little triangles.
Yeah, it does. I did not have anything to do with designing that. I think that I had the same reaction when I saw it, and I thought, well, no one else is going to think that. But I think also some of that, one of the reasons everybody thinks that is that it's yellow, and the yellow triangle numbers were always yellow triangle numbers. So it's funny that when I saw it, I thought, huh, that's kind of a yellow triangle.
And I'm going to jump back just quickly to the Superman Convergence issues. I'm always fascinated in comic books how drugs are depicted, because everyone has to be careful. Do you know whose idea it was to put little skulls and crossbones on drug packets in that number, in that issue? I'm not party to many drug deals, but I'd assume that you don't mark them poison.
At that time, and I one of the things that has been coming as a bigger topic in this country is certainly that of synthetic drugs. And I certainly know I was surprised that in the past couple of years, where you could walk into a head shop and buy like synthetic bath salts and stuff like that people were using as a drug, they'd have all sorts of crazy ass skulls and stuff on it because somehow that looked cool. So I think that if you get back to Convergent Superman number one, you were dealing with guys who were making synthetic drugs because there was no way to smuggle anything into the city. So I won't say that's totally and completely illogical.
Okay.
You know what? When you get to the point where you go to a comic convention or anywhere else in life now, and you see people walking around with caps with skulls on them and T-shirts with skulls on them and driving vans, and it's nowhere near Halloween, you kind of think, well, people think that's cool.
Okay. Now, did you have to, for issue 2 of Convergence, do you adjust your personal art style to match Lee Weeks in such a small area such as this? It's only 2 issues. Did you make adjustments?
Not really, because Lee and I were actually working at the same time. He was drawing number one, and by the time I started drawing number two, he probably had about 5 pages of number one done, and then I started drawing number two. In fact, I'm pretty sure the artwork to number two was completed before number one was. So there you go. Tales out of school.
No, I just never before have I actually realized the similarities between your two art styles. So it was a little bit of a surprise because I read both issues and went, wait a minute. I thought Lee Weeks was on this when I finished two, but you get a drawing, artist credit on it.
Yeah, I think Lee and I, what you're seeing is a couple of guys who probably agree on what makes a good comic, what makes, if Lee were here and we were all talking, we'd probably find out Lee and I like an awful lot of the same art styles and the same guys who have done work throughout the history of comics, things like that, and that our influences are probably not too radically different, and that, you know, I think that we agree very much on storytelling technique and approach.
And who are those influences? Like, any past or present, Dan, for you?
Oh, wow. That's I always see that as a mixed bag sort of question, because really, I think all of us are the product of anything we were ever exposed to. And I think some of it is you learn what not to do or what you think doesn't work as much as what does work. But certainly for me, Kirby, Buscema, Adams, then even as you get more into the 70s, guys like Walter Simonson and Mike Grell and Dave Cockrum, and just so many guys. Some of the work that Paul Gulacy was doing on Master of Kung Fu, I think, certainly had an impact on me. So I think you can go through, for me, just an awful lot of things. And some of it will be, you know, if I'm drawing a scene that takes place, say, on the bridge of a starship, there might be one kind of sensibility that I picked up from some place or some particular artist. But then, oh, all of a sudden, it's a scene that's set in a graveyard. And, you know, who did that better than Gene Colan type stuff? And so it's some of it depends on the material working on. And then somehow at the end of the day, you emerge as an artist that is just this confluence or built from this confluence of material you've been exposed to.
Now, I'm going to veer a little bit off the Superman track here, just because I'm a huge fan of Mike Grell, and I just recently found out he recommended you for your first job in comics. Do you have any stories about Mike Grell? I've been fascinated by the man for years.
What do you think? This is a 10-hour show?
I'm sorry.
No, that's more or less true. What had happened is Mike was appearing in town here shortly before I got into comic, and he was doing a store appearance. And on the way home from work one night, I stopped because I wanted to meet him, went in, and at the same time, I showed him my work. And it just so happened at that time that Mike was no longer drawing Warlord. They did have someone else on it, didn't like the way it was going, and were going to be making a change. So, you know, before long, what had come to happen is that DC took like three different guys and said, okay, here are five pages of script from Warlord 63. And basically, they had kind of a draw-off. And at the end of that process, they chose me. And that's pretty much how it all started. So, yeah, Mike and I have been buds ever since. And yeah, I have some great stories, but I won't get into those now.
more than once, we've gone to gone for a drink with a creator at a convention, and they've said, so we can have drinks and talk, or you can record something.
Exactly right.
There are no recordings from those nights. Well, as much as I love sharing stories with our listeners, I love the out of school stuff too.
Yep.
Getting back to Lois and Clark, who designed the new costume?
Lee did. We went through a couple of different drafts on that. And in fact, that's why I think the earliest version of publicity. We saw him with the red S-Shield and red belt instead. And then ultimately, as we played around with it a little more, we decided we liked the white better. It's interesting that from the first day that Dan called me and we started talking about doing the book, Dan said, and I see him in something like the black costume that you guys used in Return of Superman. And I was all over that one because I always liked that look. I think there is a certain level of dignity that goes along with that. So I was real happy to jump on that one.
I do really like that costume from Return. It didn't have a long life, but it was very striking when the character came back in that.
Yeah, I miss the mullet.
Well, yeah, don't we all? That was it. It was so yeah. Just so credit goes full circle. John Bogdanoff designed that first black costume, and so this one was designed by Lee. But obviously, there are references to that to what John had done.
Now, in this Lois and Clark, Superman's being a little bit more incognito. Was there any discussion to maybe not have him as an iconic Superman type costume? Were there a couple of experimentations maybe without that logo or shield?
Not really, because I think the uniform is important, and that is actually going to be part of the story as we go forward. So the whole concept of why he has this costume and why he wears it is going to be part of the story, because I think, you know, obviously in issue one, you see him take the cape and the red and blue suit and put it away. So, you know, by extension, then there is a story as to why he's wearing the other one that we saw. And we'll get into that.
Oh, and can you explain why the two alternative covers have him in two different uniforms?
The variant cover was actually done some time ago. So
okay.
I had expected that there would have been some changes made to make it fit more closely to what we have here.
I was wondering what that variant was actually created for, because the signature of Tony Daniel 2012 gave me a bit of a hint that it might not have worked.
Ah, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, well, and not many people realize it, but Tony is a time traveler. He has many talents. He went into the year 2015 and said, hey, I like that book. I want to do a variant cover.
Now, with all of the convergence and the different worlds what you want the readers into and not, which origin does this Superman have? Is it Secret Origins by Johns? Is it Birthright, or is it Man of Steel?
Oh, I see what you mean. If you wanted to be very technical about it, it would be the last one that you had seen prior to Flashpoint. I think for me, I don't know that I would say it's necessarily exactly any of those. I think we're being a little bit more general about it.
It is, now thinking back actually over that time, now, you had Superman in a couple of early issues of Booster Gold, and then you know a long storied run, and then you did do a run after the New 52 began. You are one of the very few creators who have written that many eras of Superman.
Yeah, probably. Although, if you go back to what was it, Booster Gold? Is that number 7 when Superman first appeared?
6 or 7?
6 or 7 right in there. That actually kind of predated some of what Byrne did, and was always, we kind of jumped the gun on some of that a little bit. But yeah, it's a cool thing to touch on that many different aspects of Superman.
Now, what's the constant for you of the character? Like, what's your touch point that you know, it is that character for you?
Ooh, I really think it is character. That to me, in all of these different concepts of, not different concepts, but different versions of Superman, I think it works best when it boils down to some very common character traits. And I think there is a nobility to the character, an understated nobility at that. I think that visually there is a sense of presence. There is a sense of quiet dignity. And I think when you start to roll all of those things together, that's when you get consistency of character. And I think that when the character doesn't work, it is, you can identify it by saying they're moving him too far away from some of those core concepts. You know, it's not necessarily about a particular villain. It's not necessarily about a particular story in and of itself. It is ultimately this idea of a man who has incredible power to do almost whatever he wanted, yet tries to live the most human and normal of lives. And I think those are really the core concepts on which Superman is built.
I've been reading some of the new Greg Pak stuff, and actually that line resonated with me, where Lois asked him, "Why did you want to live as a regular person?" And he said, "Because he, I think the line is he needed it."
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's even much more simple than that, which is to say, that's how he was raised. I mean, I have never thought or written Superman in a way in which he identified himself as Kryptonian. And the only time he did was when we did this story where we kind of called it the Krypton Man, and he was influenced by the Eradicator and all that and drifted more toward the Kryptonian version of himself. But that, to me, just served to prove the point that this is someone who grew up on a farm in Kansas and lived this tremendously normal life as a human, and his parents shaped him and molded him that way. And so for Superman, why do you choose to live that way? It is because that is exactly what he always has been. And he was, since day one, that's what he was raised to be. That was the value system that he was raised with. That's what he started to look at in terms of life. And that is the core of who he is.
I think that is a fundamental part of how readers and fans see Superman. Like, to me, because my Superman, the era that I was reading Superman every week was like from Byrne for about 10 years after that. And mm-hmm. And at that time, it really was Clark Kent is the real person, Superman's the disguise.
Right.
And I know that certainly for Silver Age folk, that wasn't the approach, particularly in the 70s.
Yeah, it wasn't, although it's funny that there were still attributes of that to the character. And I think various guys came in and sort of wrote him that way. It's just that in general, DC comics of that time were just a little more one-dimensional anyway. And it was always sort of, well, how do we get the character out of the civilian clothes as fast as possible to get him into costume and then go fight Bartok or whatever his name. And, you know, and I think that's where, when we had the weekly book, the luxury that we had is with a different Superman issue every week, we could take all sorts of time where we would, you know, take Superman out of the costume and say, here is the Clark Kent story. Let's focus on Clark and what he's doing and who he really is, because while we do that, we're still saying something about Superman.
Yeah, and that to me was the strength of that era. I mean, not only the consistency of creative teams and the luxury of time and space, but a really depth of the bench for the supporting cast.
Right, yeah. And again, that was, with the page count we had, whether it was getting into Perry's life or Cat Grant's or, you know, Bibbo's or, you know, Bibbo hanging out with Lobo, whatever it might have been, you know, we had the luxury to be able to do that. And that's one of the things that readers really got off on, too. I mean, they really enjoyed it.
Now, in the new series, Lois and Clark, is there going to be room, do you think, to have major supervillains? Mr. Mistleplip, I can never say Mr.
Mick the, that Piblik. Mike,
yes, Piblik. or just large supervillains. Is there room in a series like this?
There has to be, yes, because that is still part of what Superman is. I mean, we can't be isolated to Superman rescuing a kitten out of the tree. That's just not what this book is. There has to be room for that bigger-than-life type stuff. And part of what's happening here in this book is there's a bit of a Minority Report type of mission aspect to this book where all of a sudden Superman finds himself on another Earth. And on his world, you know, he knows that person X became bad guy Y. And so on this Earth, he checks out person X to see if they're going to become bad guy Y. And what are the surprises? What are the differences? Because it is still, you know, he still has that mission. And that's part of what you were seeing in the first issue by bringing Hank Henshaw into it.
Oh, no word of a lie. That gave me chills when that name showed up in this book. It's definitely my favorite Superman villain. One of my favorite villains ever. And it's who I was pulling for to be the real Superman back when we were betting on that sort of thing.
Which, yeah, you know, that ad campaign really still bothers me this day because it didn't really pay off at all. It was hard to pay out on those bets.
Oh, well, you know, I have always looked back at that and thought that, you know, the idea of coming back with four Supermen, yeah, that were going to be written in such a way as to make everybody think that they were the real McCoy, I really do think was, if you take the whole death of Superman, the entire storyline, that idea was the best of any idea we had. And it's all because we were trying to figure out how to bring Superman back, and we didn't have a plan, we didn't know what to do, and we all had our own ideas. It's because Wheezy Simonson sat there and said, oh, it's too bad we can't do them all. And, you know, from there, the conversation started going down the road of, well, wait a minute, maybe there's a way to do that. And so that kind of goes full circle back to what we were talking about earlier with the generation of an idea and how does it become, an actual book. But I'm sorry you were disappointed. I'm sorry we let you down.
Disappointed is a weird word in this one. I was just sort of frustrated that I wanted one of those four guys because I spent a lot of time studying, trying to figure which one. The assumption was one of them was going to be the new Superman. And well, in truth, not really.
All right, Chris, are you asking for your money back?
I'll see you. Well, I bought it three times now, so I can hardly be considered a disgruntled buyer, but still, I spent a lot of time studying. Like, the only one I could X out was the Superboy character.
Yeah,
which I recently went back and reread.
Just from a writer's standpoint, I did everything I could to make it seem like the cyborg Superman was the real one. And quite honestly, when I did the cover where he's kind of wrapped up in the cape, I kind of thought, okay, I got this one now. That if there was a vote, he'd win. And the whole idea was that because he was going to be exposed as the villain behind everything, that I thought that would be the best way to jerk the rug out from everyone's feet. So I guess I apologize.
I do love, I really like that point though in Lois and Clark, bringing in Henshaw, because it has a bit of that, it has a bit of Cassandra, you know, that he can see some of these coming, but he doesn't want to, he can't tell anyone.
Right. Well, he and it's only that he kind of sees them coming. I think I explained it to somebody once by saying it this way, that for him, it's like when you wake up in the morning and you had a dream, and all you can remember is like three or four details of that dream, and you know it was long and elaborate, and there was a lot of realism to it, but it's like you reach out and you think you can touch it, but it's not there. And in a way, that's what it's like for Superman. I mean, he has his memories, but this is a different place, and it's a different world. So when we start to get into this, it really is. Is it for any of these characters, are they the same guy or are they not the same guy? And to Clark and Lois, those are always going to have different answers.
It does remind me of how the Golden Age Superman related to the pre-Flashpoint universe.
Yeah.
You know, that outsider, but everything seems to echo.
Right. Now, I always thought part of the problem with that was it's almost as though they never tried to live in the world. You know, it's like, Lois, go ahead, put on that pillbox hat. Let's go outside and see what people say. And I think the whole point of this one is they're doing their best to make this home.
And power level wise, how does, I mean, now currently the Superman, the new 52 Superman's depowered, but at his peak, how do these two these characters compare?
That's obviously good story material, and one that would be far better shown in a comic than talked about here in a podcast.
So you're saying issue 9?
There you go.
I've never had a comic dedicated to me. You just throw it in the notes section.
Right.
Chris, do you have anything else you want to add here?
You're doing a wonderful job. I'm enjoying it greatly. I'm glad I get to listen to it first.
I have another triangle number question, actually.
Sure.
So you worked from before the triangle numbers. I actually don't know what year you left Superman, because you started in 89?
Yeah, 88. Well, actually, I think I drew the Adventures of Superman annual, like probably 87, 88, and then I did move right into some of the backup stuff. So yeah, back in there somewhere, long time.
Now, to you, I mean, some different creators came and went in that time. You had a lot of collaborators who were there almost that whole length of time. Like, what was the high watermark for you?
Well, obviously, and it sounds very almost hackneyed to say it, but it is true. And obviously, the death of Superman was a high point, just because it was so. I mean, there was no way we could ever anticipate anything like that. We could never anticipate a reaction like that. It was bigger than anything we could have seen coming. And there's tremendous satisfaction that goes along with that. That having been said, I look back at it, and I think one of the things I take satisfaction in, and I think a lot of us do, is that I think we sort of invented and perfected a particular method of storytelling that worked very, very well. And it started to emerge when we were just three books with some of the things we did that got into you know, Panic in the Sky and things like that, you know, the Dark Knight over Metropolis, you know, and we were sort of feeling our way, so that by the time we did get into the death of Superman, we had really figured out how to work as a team and how to tell really big, expansive stories in a way that was pretty darn seamless across the books. And I've watched other people try and do it since, and they just stumble and fall. And So I think that part of it is we really became a band that was firing on all cylinders, where we could handle different sorts of things. And I think we built a very strong presence for the books that way.
Well, I loved the first issue of Lois and Clark. Disappointed there's no triangle number on it, but I'm going to continue anyway.
Okay.
maybe by the time we get to I assume there's a big September event that's going to spin off out of that. Then that's when they can bring it back.
I'm still worrying about this past September to even talk about. Think about 2016. We have to get through winter first.
And so you've got 12 issues of Lois and Clark. Batman Beyond continues to be a success. Batmite's going to wrap up here. Do you have other things on the horizon, or is that taking up your time?
That as though all that isn't enough, I am also going to be drawing the Superman Annual. That's coming up here pretty quick. So I have a very, very full plate.
Just out of curiosity, do you think we'll see Jonathan Swift maybe in one of your other titles coming up?
Oh, that would be, I think, a stretch at this point.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
All right.
Or I said Swift, I meant White, sorry.
Well, I kind of figured that, yeah.
All right, any last thoughts, Chris?
No, it's just great talking with Dan Jurgens.
Well, thanks.
Dan, is fantastic having you back. Once again, I've just barely touched on Booster Gold. We will at some point do a talk just about that, because I have all of the questions.
Okay, that sounds good. I'd enjoy that.
And so anything you want to plug, Dan? Besides,
you know, I would like everybody to check out Lois and Clark. I think it's a lot of fun, because not only does it evoke, I think, some feelings of the past, but I also think we have some good, fun, fresh surprises coming up. Batmite, obviously, it's coming to an end. Sad to see that happen. And at the same time, you know, we're pushing ahead full steam on Batman Beyond, and I think we have all any number of huge surprises coming up on that one.
And collected edition of Batman Beyond and Batmite around February, March time?
Yeah, I think that's right, yes.
So not too late. You can buy that as a Christmas present. Just put a little IOU card.
Exactly right. Make them wait.
And we're
anything worth having is worth waiting for just a bit.
And we're getting, as Chris mentioned, volume one of Booster Gold is turning up on Comixology, a couple at a time. And
yes, indeed.
So thanks again, Dan. And hopefully next time we talk, there will be a major motion picture of Booster Gold or a TV show that we're talking about.
Well, that'd be fun too. But, yeah, thanks. It's always fun. I always appreciate it. Always good chatting with you guys.
Fantastic. And we are OUT.